Hey everybody, welcome to Crew Call 5-2. This is the February show, which we made the month only because it's leap year. And that's the way it is when you have busy people and you're trying to get interesting, busy people together for a conversation. But that's just what we've got here right now. We've got Bob Sprague, who has a lot of things to talk about related to what he's doing in model railroading, but also some stuff that he did for Scotty Mason. And we have our returning champion, Scott Mason, as the second part of the triad here. So the reason I got everybody on here, I happened to be looking at the December 2023 issue of Model Railroader. And Bob had an article in there called The PC in Belafonte, PA. And he, in the article, among other things, he talks about a track plan, I believe, that he did for Scott back in the day. And I just thought, what? Why am I just learning about this here now? So I figured I'd get these guys on and get some straight answers. So without further ado, Scott, Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be back.
Yeah, really good to see you, Mike.
So, Bob, what can you say about, this thing that I just talked about, this track plan that you did for Scott? Like, how long ago are we talking, and why hasn't Scott built this layout?
Well, you'll have to ask Scott that, but my main impression is that he moved about the time I finished the design. But he back in the day when he had headlined his own podcast, he put out a contest offer for a track plan for his space, which was not large, but I took that up as a challenge, and he was running a little contest, and I won. I was very pleased and gratified and honored. But
each other prior to that, or was that something that how you guys met?
Well, actually, I'll jump in, Bob, because that's what I do. But I've been paying Bob off for years. I'm kidding. Bob was actually incredibly kind and generous enough to develop and kind of run roughshod over my website for many years, and did so gratis and hopefully, you know, with my abundant thanks. So I certainly knew Bob, but this contest, Mike, before we get started here, you were talking about how old we are. And, you know, they say the memory is the first thing to go, and then you forget what the second thing is. You were on that podcast at that time.
I was.
You were the co-host of the show back then, Michael.
I can go one better on this, actually. When I was looking for Bob's email address tonight, I thought, what's his email address? Because if the name isn't in the email address, how do you find it, right? So I started searching various parameters in Gmail. I did send you a Facebook IM, but I found all kinds of emails between us, like going back years ago. Like, apparently I did sound installs for you. Who knew?
You did beautiful sound installs for me.
Yeah. Who knew? I couldn't have told you that if my life depended on it. So, I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds ago, but man, it's not encouraging to think that I have zero memory of doing that.
It's all good, Mike. We'll get through this together.
Okay. Takes a village now.
So the background was, and I want to say this was about 2013-ish, maybe 14. I had gotten divorced a couple of years before, and my youngest daughter had come to live with me, and I rented a house. I had a multi-year lease on a house in the town that I lived in, and the house had a small room, kind of a spare bedroom type room, and I thought, you know, this would be, you know, if we turn this into a contest, and I'm sure that you and I had a fairly lengthy conversation about this before we implemented it, if we started this contest, I'd get some design ideas, because I don't have that. I don't have any creativity whatsoever.
I might have to go back and listen to that podcast.
And I also thought that, you know, it was a room that was small enough that I could build, you know, whatever was drawn. And Bob's right. The contest ended, and the landlady showed up one Saturday morning and explained that she was canceling the lease after a year. and she needed to move back into her house.
Hmm.
And so that put the kibosh on all future plans for that space. And I honestly, I had forgotten all about it till you brought this article to my attention. And so I ran to the bookstore and picked up the magazine, and it all came rushing back to me. But Bob did such a great job in this little space.
And Bob, you had nothing to go by except the room dimensions and maybe where the door and window was, right?
That's right. And I think Scott had talked about it being a Penn Central era. So I sort of said, well, that might narrow us down to someplace in Pennsylvania, and started Googling. And it's a neat little area, which by the way, I've subsequently probably done three or four plans for people based on that Penn Central or Conrail line through Belafonte and State College in that area, because it's a neat little area with fair amount of railroad remaining.
I'm not intimately familiar with that particular spot. So what line is that on? Is that on what like if it was in Conrail times, would it still exist?
Yeah, well, we were talking about short-term memory, weren't we? What's the town at the north end of it, Scott?
Oh,
It
hold on,
runs.
page 44. Let's see.
Just to get a locus here.
Yeah.
So we've got Milesburg, we've got Pleasant Gap, we've got Unpleasant Gap. No, I'm kidding. And we've got Belafonte.
All right. So I think we've concluded that none of us know exactly where that is.
Not anymore. I'm looking here. I'm looking.
And Bob, have you done a lot of this kind of track plan creation in the past, or was this just something you just took a flyer on when Scott brought that out?
No, I have been a track planner for a long time, and recently did a quick calculation that I'd probably done, in the range of 200, 250 plans for other
Jeez.
people.
So this wasn't your first rodeo by any
No, it
stretch.
was not. And meanwhile, I've found the bald eagle branch is what we're talking about, and it.
Is that Nittany and Bald Eagle, like that same
Yeah, I think it's
line
that's
now?
in the same area, and sort of the north end is Lock Haven.
Yeah, I know the area. Okay.
It's southwest from there through Belafonte, and then links back up with the main line in where. Yeah, I'll find that in a second. Sorry, Mike.
That's okay. This makes for scintillating audio.
Yeah, right. They want to hear us clicking while we search desperately for things
I
we don't
actually have some
remember.
fond memories of that area. I thought the Nittany and Bald Eagle was a very, very cool little short line, and I think I probably discovered it, from my experience anyway, on the same trip that I ended up stumbling upon the area that I ended up modeling. So that was a good trek through Pennsylvania where I was just rambling all over the place, just looking at things that weren't the usual.
So was that a branch line off the Middle Division?
It comes off in Tyrone, which is what I was trying to remember.
So I think the answer to that is yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Tyrone up through Bald Eagle, up through Belafonte and Lock Haven, and then eventually links back up with the line in Williamsport. So,
Right, Williamsport. So it isn't that Buffalo line though?
Could be, yes. I was just out that way about a week ago.
Were you?
Yeah.
Did
And
you get to do any rail fanning out there?
I rode along the Erie Main Line. I was in Jamestown, New York, and which was a fairly substantial town for the Erie. But that Erie Main Line runs east to west or west to east in this case. And it follows Route 88 or 86, whatever it is, through New York. And you're bumping up against the Pennsylvania border. So
Okay.
I probably crossed that main line, the Pennsy main line, at some point.
I'm assuming you chose the worst weather possible to do that in.
No, it was actually fine. The beautiful thing about that ride was there was not one other car on the highway the entire time. It was a
Don't
seven
you
and a
love
half
that?
hour
Oh,
ride.
it's like how driving used to be.
Yeah, and I put the cruise control on 80, took a nap. I know it
Long
was,
driving your way.
yeah, no, it was perfect. But I didn't know, I didn't have Mike with me to tell me what I was looking at. So I wasn't sure if that was the east-west line was Pennsy or what it was. And then when I got to Jamestown, they have a viaduct, stone viaduct that has carved in it the Erie Railroad. So once I saw that, it was, dawn shining over Marblehead.
Right. So, Bob, you said 200 or so track plans. That's kind of a lot. So, I are you like, were you doing them commercially, or just do you have that many friends?
I have a little business. It's just enough to keep me off the streets, where I do, a couple a month, and people find their way to me. I have a website, and have had a number of articles in Model Railroader over the years. In fact, they ran another plan in January. They tend to do that. They hadn't run any since 2019, and then all of a sudden, two in 2 months. But anyway, people attract me down from that stuff, or get referred from
Good
previous
exposure.
clients.
Yeah.
And
Now, do you do something with 3D printing at all? Did I see that?
yeah, I do a lot of 3D printing, a lot of design, and mostly stuff for myself, my own railroad. I did break down and invest in a 3D printer about a year ago, which has been a great way to waste a tremendous amount of time. But
I
it's a lot
think
of
I'm the
fun.
last guy that doesn't have a 3D printer, but because I'm in IT and I'm on the computer like way too much, the last thing I want to do, it's like Photoshop. I mean, everybody's doing all the fancy stuff in Photoshop, and I look at Photoshop and I think, oh, another steep learning curve, spend hours at it to get really good at it thing. So I tend to outsource that to guys like Mike Confalone and Lance Minheim, and get what I need, because it's not, I'm not looking to spend more time on the computer. On a recent show, I interviewed Matt Herman and Alec Herman, and they've got a thriving little 3D printing enterprise that they're doing there. That I look at what they're producing and how new stuff comes up all the time, and I think there's not much sleep going on with these guys because they are really, putting it to the metal there.
Very incidentally, the other activity I'm in is the Mid-Atlantic RPM meet, which we need to lure you guys to eventually. And Matt Herman is coming to be a vendor this
When
year,
does that
which
take place, Bob?
is September 5th, 6th, 7th, I want to say, this year. So
And
early in
it's
September.
was it Baltimore area?
Yeah, right near Baltimore, Washington International Airport. So right there off of 95, and
Huh.
pretty easy to get to.
That's
That's
probably that I've
actually.
never been to that meet, and it always sounds like it has a good group of folks that go there.
It's a nice vibe. Norm Wolf started it up many years ago, and then when he moved to the West, Bernie Kempinski took it over. So a lot of good clinics, a lot of good operations, some good vendors. The main problem is we've gotten kicked out of one hotel after another through no fault of our
We've got
own.
the same problem in New England. I think New England RPM is in their third hotel in maybe as many years. I mean, the days when you could just use the community center in Collinsville, are long gone. We outgrew that a long time ago. I give them credit for stick-to-itiveness and continuing to find a hotel that's looking for that kind of event. You wouldn't think it would be difficult, but apparently it is.
Well, finally,
well,
it's
Bob,
the,
I can.
exhibit space is the, you know, the tricky part. You know, you
Correct.
find a hotel, but one that's big enough, but not too big, and you know, not too expensive, and not too hard to get to, and all
Right.
that kind of stuff.
Well, you had the same issues with the Craftsman Structure Show, right, Scott? I mean,
yeah, you know, we were lucky in that, you know, back then, finding that type of space was relatively easy. And there are a lot of hotels in this area that can accommodate that type of event. This one just happened to be, you know, really local to where I live, which was convenient in dealing, going back and forth with the logistics of the convention. But
it's still
it was
borderline greater Boston area. So,
yeah,
that
well,
helped.
it was equidistant between Logan Airport and Providence. So, you know, people who are coming in could, you know, pick their poison as far as airports go. You know, I'm familiar, obviously, with, you know, what Dave Owens has gone through with you know, the meetup here. And I was involved early with Norm when he started, you know, the Mid-Atlantic RPM. And, you know, what I was going to say, Bob, is, you know, I can speak for Mike and say, you know, we'll be on a train down to Baltimore in September.
Excellent.
And
it's probably the way to go, because driving wouldn't be fun.
Well, you've had your experience driving with me anyway.
Well, what do you mean, the 16 hours straight to Chicago? That didn't
to Chicago,
work for you?
Yeah. Mike is still scarred.
We both agreed that when we were done with that, yeah, we're not going to do that again.
You haven't been able to walk since then, right, Mike?
I think that time frame, you know, may work for me this year, Bob. We've got a couple of graduations in the spring. I've got a daughter who is graduating from a little college near you called Georgetown University.
Okay, very good.
And another daughter that's graduating from high school, and she will be starting college in September, probably at Georgetown. So, you know,
I was going to say you probably have a lot more money now, but if you've got someone starting again at Georgetown, then forget that.
Well, just don't. Now, thankfully, that piece is all taken care of, and it's not an issue.
That's good.
Because if it was, I couldn't afford to front you a couple of bucks for a coffee at this point. I'll talk to Mike about that, and maybe I can lure him out of his basement. And
wouldn't you be pitching in the playoffs by that time? Or,
well, the playoffs are a little later in the fall. Yeah. So is that Labor Day weekend, Bob?
No, I think it's the week after.
Okay.
I don't think we put it on Labor Day.
That wouldn't be a good idea either from travel.
5, 6, 7, 8 is the days in September for sure.
Gotcha.
So, Bob, tell me a little bit about what your layout is and what you're modeling. I mean, I really have no idea, and other than the engines that supposedly I did for you. So,
well, very unfortunately, although I still have them, they no longer fit because I'm modeling the Maryland and Pennsylvania Railroad circa May 5th, 1924. So
diesels I did, not so much.
Diesels not so much, but having a lot of fun. It's
You changed eras. What caused you to change eras?
Well, it's a love story because I got remarried in 2016, moved to a new house in Baltimore. I say new house, it's an old house, but a new house to me. And I happened to mention to my lovely new wife that there was a railroad that ran right close to our house here in Baltimore, because the Ma and Pa ran about a quarter mile from where we live now. And she said, well, you've got to model that then. I said, well, you don't understand. I'm going to have to get rid of all the stuff I have now and go buy a whole lot more trains. And she said, well, that's what you got to do. So I love that woman. And
that's when you know you found the right woman.
That's right. But, you know, part of the rationale is that I got more and more into scratch building and 3D printing and wanting to have something that really didn't look like everybody else's railroad. And when you go 1924, there's some good stuff available. But if you really want to be authentic and prototypical, you got to build a lot of it yourself. And
can you give me an example or two of what you're talking about and things you wanted to do right, but it wasn't available, so you had to create them?
Well, boxcars, and a friend of mine and I have a joke is that when you go down the roster of the Ma and Pa boxcars, it's all about when they were wrecked. So it's amazing they had any left whatsoever. But there's some pretty nice Ma and Pa boxcars, and I bought a bunch of them that are commercially available. And then I did a little more research and realized that they had bought those from the Penzi in 1934 or something, so they didn't belong on my railroad.
From the future.
They're from the future. And so being glutton for punishment that I am, I 3D designed those authentic boxcars because there's some pretty good plans available, and printed them out with great difficulty. But now I have authentic 1924 era boxcars on the railroad. And
this sounds like the same kind of problems that our dear departed friend Craig Beeskar ran into. I don't know the exact era he was modeling, but it was like late 1800s, wasn't it?
Yeah, late 1800s, yeah.
And he, yeah. I actually still have one of his cars here that he had made up as a resin kit, I think. But Bob, if you're printing cars, you know, for the roster for your railroad, I mean, how long did it take you to print a car, and how many cars have you made?
I've probably made a dozen, not different models. That's one of the beauties of doing your own 3D printing. Of course, is once you get it right, you can print as many of them as you want to. Mm-hmm. To be honest, I probably printed 9 or 10 versions before I got it to work right, because
it sounds about right from what I hear. Yeah.
A lot of art to how you orient things to get the best quality. And, you know, you think you got it right, and then you take it out and come back a day later and it's warped or something like that. So there's a lot of experimentation to get things oriented the right way, and it's a design process. I mean, I kind of enjoy it. I came up with a lot of the skills by doing all the track planning. It was not hard for me to pick up some of the 3D software that
you do all your track planning in some form of CAD on the computer.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
What do you use?
I use a not very well known program called MacDraft, which I'm kind of stubborn about because I started using it 20 years ago, and it's sort
you
of
know it
now. I've experimented with some of the model railroad specific packages like CAD rail and things like that, and either I'm too old to learn a new package, or it just I'm so used to doing it the way I do it that I've stuck with it. But it's a good flexible program, and you know, comes in handy for doing blueprints of buildings you want to scratch build and things like that as well.
And what software are you using for the 3D printing creation?
SketchUp.
Yeah. And none of this has anything to do with your day job. This is just something you took upon yourself to learn and master.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I've, you know, been model railroading a lot longer than I've been doing what I do professionally. So it's always been a passion.
That's a funny thing. You get good at it after a while if you do it long enough, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, sometimes you think so, and then sometimes you think like you've never done anything like this ever before, and you're going to shoot yourself rather than try to finish it. But luckily we get over those times.
It's funny. I had an inquiry from a guy just like out of the blue, and wanted to know if I would do a sound install on an ancient Concorde E unit.
Mm-hmm.
Concorde, that goes back just a bit here. So I ended up doing a little email exchange with the guy, and ended up on the phone with him. We chatted for an hour. Basically, he's a guy that had been model railroading, in his youth. And I said to him, your story is almost a cliche that, you know, you get married, you have kids, you do your career thing, you finally get kids out of the house and things settle down, and you pick up the hobby again at some point. And that's kind of what he's doing, except that he was hoping to use all the stuff from the 60s. And I said, you know, you might want to just reconsider that a little bit, because the state of the art has moved along quite a bit. And it wouldn't make sense to pay someone like me to do this fancy install on a 1960s vintage engine. It's just nuts to try to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear multiple times. And we ended up having this far-reaching conversation about track and turnouts and layout building and all of this. He's like right on the cusp of retiring and diving into this full force. So I just thought, you know, benefit from some of my own mistakes, you know, because that's how we learn, right? We do things, we try things, we screw it up, and with a little luck, you don't keep making the same mistake over. You go on to another mistake and you learn from that. But like in my case, if you're looking at a half century's worth of mistakes, theoretically, you've learned a lot in that time process, right? So how far along is your layout at this point?
Well, you know, I had to do a design for myself that proved that the things I designed for other people are possible to build. So it's a three-decker. And not terribly large overall, probably, you know, I think it's 13 by 25 feet or something like that, but thick with details. And what I sort of didn't realize when I started into this was that I was going to have to build it in chunks. So I have
maybe layers,
two or three, maybe two thirds of the way around three layers. Three decks, and I'm just now connecting them. So I've sort of had three independent railroads on shelves.
Interesting. So did you end up constructing a helix to connect them, or?
I call it the helix from hell. Not that it works that way, because it actually works very well, but it's pretty complicated, because it starts, the lowest deck comes around, goes up a few turns to the second deck, which goes around a couple more turns to the third deck. And then when the third deck comes around, it goes back down the helix on a.
So it's a double track helix.
The double track helix. And the reason I did that was that Ma and Pa ran from Baltimore to York, Pennsylvania. And to have a yard that was at nose level would be no way to operate it. And right. B, York was almost as low sea level wise as Baltimore, so it didn't make sense to have it way up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So thought about it for a while, but then figured that you know, I could just take it back down the helix, so York is now at a nice comfortable operating level.
So all three levels are scenic. It's not like one is a staging level.
No three deck.
So and how high is the highest, and how high is the lowest, just to give us some idea of the, you know, the separation?
Yeah. The lowest is 40 inches. The highest is in the range of 64 inches. And I this is sort of proof of concept. You know, people usually use 16 to 20 inches separation between decks. And certainly if I design a two level layout, that's what I aim for. But if you're careful and clever about it, you know, and Tony Custer's made this point many times, is a lot of times when you have an operating railroad, when you're going from town to town, there's not much to look at. There's not much to get excited about. It doesn't have to be deep. It doesn't have to be terribly well scenic. It just has to make the connection.
It does to make you feel like you're going somewhere, though.
You feel like you're going somewhere, but you're not going to stand there and study it. You're going to wait till you get to the next town and get some fun stuff. So I made a point of trying to make sure that one town was not directly above another town, and the decks sort of go in and out. So if you've got a lot of activity on the top deck, then the middle deck is just sort of a through part.
Gotcha.
But
I mean, if you use it 40 to 64, right? So that's 24 inches. Yeah. So each one is a foot up above the other. Do I have the math
right? Yeah, roughly. Wow. Roughly. Yeah.
So that took a little freedom thinking, I guess, to get that. That wasn't a 5-minute plan, was it?
Yeah. But it feels good to me. I haven't had a lot of others over to see it. I had my first sea trial last summer, and invited a buddy, Matt Thompson. I don't know if you guys know him, but he was up. He did a lot of the coordination of operations in the DC area. And then was moving down to the Williamsburg area. And I said, well, you know, I've been over to Matt's 100 times to operate. I need to finally pay him back and have him come over. And he said, great, I'll bring Paul Dokos and Bernie Kempinski. So
no pressure.
my first effort at operating was with those guys, but they seemed to have a good time and behaved pretty well.
Bernie is Elkem, right?
That's right.
I don't think met him in person, but I've had some dealings with him. Makes some very nice products.
Well, I don't know if
my light towers are all Elkem.
If you've seen his own railroad, he models Civil War.
Right, right.
Military, a history enthusiast, and it's like a museum piece. I mean, it's incredible.
It's
a buddy of mine has been there and spoke very highly of it. It's on the list someday, but we'll have to see. Maybe if Scott.
Well, if you come to Marpham in the fall, you'll meet him, and he usually has his layout open too. So.
Wow. That's great. So is there any scenery on yours yet, or is it?
There's a lot of dirt and nothing else areas, but what I've been doing the last couple of weeks is Tony Custer's new book is going to be on short lines, and out of the blue, he asked if I had some good photos. And I was very honored, but then realized that there are only a couple of little presentable areas on the railroad. And so I hurried up in the scenic corner of Bel Air, and the photo came out pretty nice. So,
amazing what a deadline will do, isn't it?
It's amazing what a deadline will do. A lot of it is just sort of roughed in scenery so far because I've been concentrating on getting the darn thing running.
Yeah, but boy, isn't it way better than bare plywood?
Yes, yes.
It's altering the experience. And what I found is as I started to get certain areas of my layout done, I might go from a pretty well scenic area to an area of nothingness. And it just like takes you right out of what you're doing. And it's very motivating to get that next bare area done and out of the way. So, you multiply that out enough times and I don't really have many dead areas anymore. Certainly none that are in between anything else. So that's kind of been a very transformative experience when you're operating on the layout. If you ever get up this way, you should look me up. We'd be happy to
show you around. I really love to see it.
Scott, how's your layout coming?
Well, Mike, as you know, there isn't one. I'm very happy with the projects I'm working on now, to the point
it's not like you're doing nothing. I mean, you're still building. Structure building was always your thing.
I would say I'm known for that. But I would say that I have other interests. I love operating trains. And as you know, I'm not very good at it.
You're not very good at attending op sessions, but
no, that's true too. I might get better at actually operating trains if I showed up for a few of the op
sessions. Just saying.
Mike is gracious enough to throw out an invite every time he has an op session, and it always feels like I'm someplace, out of the driving distance of Mike's home.
I wasn't impressed with that 5.5 hour distance.
Yeah.
In your younger days, that would have been nothing.
Jeffersonville, Vermont is a little bit of a haul to North Dartmouth. But I'm up to my neck in it. And I'm not running trains, but I'm building model railroad exhibits.
Well, you're keeping your hand in, obviously, right?
My hands and my feet and my earlobes.
So in case anybody is just hearing about that for the first time, you somehow got roped into building these historical displays for your town.
Yeah. So,
and you've done it, 2 years in a row?
2 years in a row. And I'm working on the third one now. As some of the listeners may remember, I served on the town council in town here for a number of years and swore that I would never get involved in another town government agency, until my wife suggested maybe the historical commission might be a good fit for me in whatever spare time I had, because of my love of history, and got appointed to the historical commission and was sitting at the first meeting, and Gentleman next to me starts elbowing me in the ribs. And he says, hey, he says, you're that train guy. And I, you know, I could feel the rocks loosening up and starting to roll downhill. And I said, yeah. And he said, you know, I've had an idea for an exhibit for a number of years, and I don't have the ability to execute it, but I bet you do. And so he laid out this whole concept of you know, picking a bygone period and modeling it as accurately and historically as I could. You know, I think all of these town historical museums are wanting of exhibits. You know, they have the static displays that are there forever, but in terms of new exhibits, there isn't much. And
think of the barrier to entry, right, for getting new material. How many people are able to and willing to do that kind of thing? Now,
you're absolutely right. And
you're the only one I've met.
Well, and I knew that this was going to be a little bit of a daunting task because I was the only one really that was going to be rolling up their sleeves for this. So I drew up an outline that it was a 6-year project, one new exhibit each year for 6 years. The first exhibit focused on the center of my town, Franklin, Mass, which was on the...
Why 6 years?
Well, it was just based on the mills in town, the railroad infrastructure. In order to capture it all, I basically cut it into six chunks.
I see. The total scope of the thing would take six projects to accomplish.
Sure. And figuring that each chunk was doable in a 12-month period.
Yep.
So the first piece of this focused on the center of town, the railroad station. There was a coal and grain company across the parking lot from the station. There was a piano factory on the hill overlooking the station.
Was that the one we got the foam for, or was that the second?
Yes. Yeah, no, that was the one we got the foam for. And I started this. I joined the Historical Commission in August. I started this project in the end of August and built basically an 8-foot by 3-foot exhibit. To scale with fidelity. It went on exhibit the first weekend in December. So in about 3 months.
Wow.
I did the research.
You were sweating that one though.
It was painful. It's like being 3 months overdue with your third child. I mean, you just want to get this thing done. So you know, all the CAD work, all the laser cutting, and then, you know, just assembling all of these structures. And it wasn't without its false starts. I had built the station in town and didn't like the way it came out. It was a station that was originally built in 1928 and still stands to this day. A good friend of mine who's a member of the New Haven Railroad Historical Society found the builder's plans for it. So another good friend of mine who...
This was after you did one iteration of it?
After one iteration, yeah, okay. Because the clock wasn't ticking. another good friend of mine who is very competent with CAD, and also I co-own a laser with him, took the drawing, imported it into his CAD program, and basically traced out all the walls, windows, doors, everything, scaled it down. And then when we ran it through the laser cutter, we had an exact replica of the station. So I learned a lot from that 3-month sprint. Interestingly enough, I think the other historic commissioners had no idea what to expect. We didn't know what kind of attendance we would draw as a result of this. On a normal weekend in our museum, we get maybe a half a dozen people.
Six.
No, a half dozen. And we
make sure I heard that right.
Yeah, we opened the doors to this, and we were getting, you know, 30, 40 people right off the bat. And then word spread. So it was on display for a month and a half. We have a Second Sunday speaker series, And so in conjunction with the exhibit, myself and the de facto town historian did a presentation on these buildings in this area. And that drew a completely full house. We had about 70 people there for that presentation. And then I began to work on the second exhibit, which went on display this past December. And there was already, you know, a vibe about it.
It was buzz.
There was a buzz going, and we had promoted it through a local town podcast. It had gotten quite a bit of press. So we actually ended up having a ribbon cutting ceremony for it when it went on display. We were averaging over 100 people a weekend.
Now, are both modules on display? Is it eventually going to be six different scenes all on display together?
Well, I'm not sure it's going to be six at this point. I've kind of modified my plan and my expectation a little bit. These exhibits, the first two are pretty big. The first one was 3x8. The second one was 4x5. And this third one that I'm working on now is 4x8. And the mill that I'm recreating is absolutely massive. I would argue with anybody that I've never seen a bigger structure built on a model railroad anywhere.
Wow. And you've seen Mahoopany.
And I've seen Mahoopany. Yeah. Yeah. The Charmin plant is smaller.
Wow. Well, this is a multi-story, right? Like, how many stories is it?
Well, it's a multi-level in terms of the grade of the land. So one side of the mill is two story, and it drops down and becomes a three story. So it was a mill that was originally, the original portions of it were built in the 1870s. This was a textile mill.
It's wood construction?
No, it's all brick. There's one small wood, nothing is small on it. The one wooden annex is a foot long. So in and of itself, it's a whole structure, but,
and there must be a zillion windows in this thing.
Well, there's a zillion windows, and they all had to be custom drawn, and cut. There was nothing commercial that I could find that even remotely matched it.
Really? So you made the windows?
Well, and so here's the thing, right? I mean,
Bob's thinking,
this,
yeah, why not?
I'm building this to exact scale. It will be an exact replica of this mill. So the likelihood of finding a plastic masonry window. And by the way, there are, you know, the
I mean, you looked
is,
at all the tissue stuff and.
Oh, everything. Yeah. And I learned real early that, you know, there was no way that was going to work. There are six or seven different window designs that all had to be drawn. So, like all mills built at that period, you know, they were reliant upon daylight. They weren't electrically lit until much later.
Right. So does that mean there's, are there roof windows as well?
No, there is a clear story in one section of the mill.
Those angled ones?
Yeah, you know, yeah. This is a
typical, a lot of that in the New Bedford textile mills as well.
Yeah, this is a typical, you know, shotgun approach to building, in that they started building in the 1870s. They built another addition in the early 1900s. The last addition was finished in 1928. So it's got some different architecture to it. It's not a linear design by any stretch of the imagination. If the listeners want to take a look at it, the mill still exists, thankfully, because I'm literally running down there, you know, two times a week to mm-hmm. double check measurements. If they go on Google Earth and they do a search of the Franklin Mass Mill Store, you'll see it. My buddy, the CAD guy, I was with him for a while today. He was showing me the windows. We have a footprint, and I have probably 3/4 of the walls drawn at this point.
So no actual construction.
No actual construction yet. Just the research process alone is taken a few months. We're basically taking a Sanborn map from 1927, which is the closest we can get to the period that this exhibit is focused on, which is 1932, and comparing it to Google Earth to determine, what parts of the mill
Different.
were there at that point, because it had been just added on to and added on to and added on to over time, to the point where there are certain areas of the mill that you can't even get access to anymore because they're all enclosed.
It's been built around it, in other
It's
words.
been built around it, yeah. And the
So
mill
the
next,
specific year that you're doing is what?
1932.
32.
So and that so we I chose that era because it happened to be a sweet spot for information. We had a lot of photographs. We had some old movies. There were a lot of press clippings as this mill was being built. And also, it was a very interesting time for railroading in town. Franklin is on the Midland Division of the New Haven. And at this particular crossing with a main road in town, there were 10 tracks that crossed,
Jeez.
that crossed this road. And
Why 10? Was there a road across the yard? I mean, what were all these
yeah,
tracks
and
for?
none of that was a yard. So there was
Jeez.
one siding to the mill.
All
So
right.
the Midland Division ran, well, as the railroad calls it, east to west, from Boston to Newburgh, New York. There was also what was called the Milford Branch. So the lines split off,
There's a
and
junction there, yeah.
yeah, there was a junction there. And then a little further down, it split off again. And the Midland Division track split off to the left and went to through Cumberland and Valley Falls and into Providence that way.
And somehow all of these tracks cross that road.
All those tracks crossed that road.
Wow.
So there's been a lot of photography. There's been a lot of head scratching to determine dimensions of things that I couldn't get in with a measuring tape. Google Earth, as you know, is an invaluable tool when it comes
Use it
to
all
that
the
stuff.
time, yeah.
I know you do. And I really kind of picked up from what you were doing and used it for my own research, because there was no other way to do it. The woman who owns the mill now, she's a third generation owner. Her grandfather bought it in 1949. Is very leery of my existence.
Really?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of an unfortunate circumstance, and through no fault of her own, she's in a little bit of a battle with the Conservation Commission in town. This was a textile mill. Across from her mill was another mill that's actually part of this exhibit as well. It was also a textile mill, and there's a sluice way that runs between the two mills. And the buildings that border the sluice way were the dye houses. You see where this is going?
Super fun site.
So there you can literally see the clay pipes that come out of the
Oh,
retaining
jeez.
walls, where they just dumped buckets of dye, right into the sluice way, which emptied out into wetlands behind another mill on the other side of the tracks.
What could be wrong with
Well,
that?
there was also a well that was dug to supply water to the dye house. And they because in Massachusetts we have four seasons, and it gets damn cold in the winter, except for the most part this winter. They built a tin clad enclosure, octagonal enclosure over this well
Okay.
that was insulated with asbestos.
Okay.
So about 10 years ago, the enclosure collapsed finally after, 130 years. And the asbestos got into the sluice way and emptied out into the wetlands. So the Conservation Commission has been after her to clean up the enclosure, which she did. But she's very leery about anybody associated with the town being on a property, and she's I think I've got it to warm up to me a little bit. We're going to produce a documentary in conjunction with this project.
Jeez.
That'll be available on YouTube. And we would like very much for her to be part of that because I'm sure she's got a very interesting story to tell. But at this point, it's kind of what are you doing here today? That sort of thing. And
Measuring something.
yeah, see the tape measure and my laser. And she just hasn't been able to kind of understand why anyone would be doing this anyway.
She's probably normal.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure she, she's an older lady, and I'm sure she's a little scared. This mill is not full of tenants, and there's probably a lot of limits to what she can do with it, in terms of selling it, because you're right, it probably is a Superfund site. And then the other issue is that the mill that's adjacent to it literally encroaches. I mean, you would look at this and say, how the hell did they ever get a building permit to do any of this? Well, the fact is, you didn't need a building permit in those days. You had a, maybe a contract with the other mill owner or a handshake agreement, and you just, you built wherever they let you build. So there's not a real delineation of where one property ends and the other starts.
So, getting back to your display, get this 4x8 thing that you're going to build on a sheet of something. And how are you going, you get space to work on that at your house, I guess. That's where you're going to work on it.
I am allowed to use one side of my garage.
And how are you going to move it?
Well, so this has been the big issue with the first two exhibits because there's really no space in the museum to store them. The first one we were able to, there was a little bit of storage room on the second floor of the museum, but maneuvering that exhibit up and down the winding staircase was a little bit of gut-wrenching. So I'm friends with the DPW director, and I went down and I had a talk with him. I said, hey, is there any place here we could store these things if we build some crates for them? He said, oh, absolutely. We got tons of storage space. So the deep, and these are, I've donated these to the town. So they're town
And they're
property. It's
yours.
not like they're moving my personal belongings, but they've been fantastic. And we had two crate, a crate built for each of the first two. The DPW came and delivered the crates from the gentleman who built them. We packed up the exhibits and they moved them off to this mezzanine level storage area in a repair facility, and they'll be safe there until we need them again. So,
You have an intruder.
the third, what this allows me to do now that I have a place to store it is really kind of push the construction of this one a little faster. It's going to take me, if I get this done by early December, it's going to be a little bit of a miracle. There's
Wow.
just a lot to this. But I know I have a place to store it, even if it's before it goes on exhibit. And the DPW will deliver them to the museum when it's time to set them up.
That's interesting. It's interesting that you were talking about windows because you probably saw how I was building this curtain wall building for this particular new spot. It's the latest pictures I've been posting on the group. And I'm building the building largely to scale, but I'm fudging the dimensions a little bit around what's available to me from a window standpoint. So if you were to get right down and count the number of panes, they're not exactly right. And I could let that bother me, but I'm not because I'm limited to what's possible, I'm trying to capture the feel of this thing. I think it's going to be fine, and I doubt anybody is going to be a pane counter. You know what I mean?
I think 99% of the time in the hobby, even if you're the most strict prototype modeler, you have to make that compromise.
You gotta pick your
Uh,
battles.
it
I
it just
mean,
you
not
know
everything's
uh,
a fence to die on.
well you know and the other and I was talking to my buddy about this today because he said, geez, this you could turn these into kits. And I said, well, if I had a head injury, I could. The issue is that there's no selective compression in these whatsoever. They're completely to scale and they're huge.
So unless anybody needs an 8 foot long factory.
Well, I did a printing press mill for the exhibit last year, the second exhibit, And it was over 2 feet long and you know, 2 feet wide. And
Right.
you know, I mean, it's
And how many people have that amount of space to do their modeling in?
very few,
You
very
know,
few.
it's
Or,
not
you know,
meant, there's probably not that many
or
three-level layouts, Bob, really. I mean, when you come right down to it.
you know, from a kit manufacturer's perspective, and at the risk of sounding a little cynical, you know, who in the hobby has that kind of money to spend on a mill that large that had 400 windows in it?
Do you miss the kit business at all?
Yeah, but I also miss getting punched in the gut. You know what I miss? The
That could
things
be
I miss
arranged.
are the things that don't make you any money about it. So I miss the research. I miss the CAD time, and I'm not nearly as fluent at it as Bob is. You know, maybe that's a conversation that he and I need to have at some point. Sorry, Bob. You know, I miss building the pilot models, and to a lesser degree, but still, I miss going to the shows and talking about it a little bit. I don't miss going to all of the shows that I used to have to go to.
Hey, somebody asked me the other day, did you go to the Big E show this year? And I said, no. And
Yeah, I
I
went.
haven't gone in quite a few years now. And
Yeah, I
what I
went.
generally say is, I think being a vendor there for 3 years in a row pretty much took the starch out of me, and I just have no urge to go back, even though it's quite an event. And if you've never been, you should have that experience, you know, and decide if an intimate weekend with 20,000 of your not closest friends is for you.
Well, and this year they say that they claim they had 26,000. And from what I saw the Saturday I was there, I can't disagree.
Right.
So, you know, I'm up to my neck in this one. You know, just the materials alone, you know, purchasing all the materials alone is daunting. I've been fortunate in that I've been given funding from the Friends of the Historical Museum, which is a fundraising arm of the museum. You know, the whole key is, you know, just getting people in. And you know, they'll
Does the
back anything
funding
that
cover your costs on it?
not completely.
How could it, right?
Well, it did last year, but you know, it was this interesting thing. You know, I had to get geared up. You know, I hadn't done anything like this, and I really hadn't been up to my neck in the hobby in quite a while. I kind of been lurking around the fringes a little bit, as you know, and I had for the first year, I had to go out and buy all new scenery material and, you know, boxes of trees and, you know, all sorts of strip wood and, you know, everything that I needed. And a lot of that was left over. So I had a lot of materials that I bought the first year
Yeah,
carry
you
me
weren't
through the
starting from
second.
scratch the second time.
Yeah. And,
But
but,
the basswood people must be very happy with you.
well, and I had, tons and tons of basswood left over from the kit manufacturer
Oh,
day.
okay.
But I will say that I'm running low. It's getting down there. And it'll be interesting to see this year if I have to go out and buy some more, because the prices of wood have not gone down any
Nope.
since I was making kits. And
You get the
you
raw
know,
materials from somebody like Northeastern, or?
Northeastern, yeah, and they're great to work with.
Yeah, they are.
They really are. But you know, the brick sheets are coming from Jimmy Simmons.
Oh, okay. So you're not creating those from scratch then.
Well, so yes and no. So you know, there are sills and lintels on, you know, all these windows that we had to draw. And then, you know, we're doing a copy paste into the CAD. So you know, the brick that's around it will be his sheets that have been cut out, you know, for the window openings, and that the lintels and sills will be glued in, and then the windows will be glued into, you know, in back of those.
I'm fascinated that you're going to cut these windows. I mean, it's just going to be, what's the material you're cutting them out of?
So I don't know exactly what it's called.
You've seen Jimmy's industrial windows, right?
Yeah, colloquially, it's easy for me to say. It's known as laser board,
Oh, yeah.
and you get it through Northeastern, and it comes in a number of different thicknesses, and you can layer it so you can get a 3D effect for the, you know, the windows and the sills, yeah, which is nice.
I considered using those for my building, but his didn't have the right number of panes either as is, and I thought it might be easier to kitbash him out of styrene existing windows, which is what I ended up doing.
Well, I think, you know, like I said, if you go on Google Earth and you know, you take a look at this mill and you see the, you know, the size, the sheer sizes of the windows, you know, the main mill window is 100 inches wide, 114 inches tall. It's got an arched
Jeez.
Top. You know, these are not just simple, you know, 6x6 windows.
So in an arch top window, typically the bricks are laid out like in a soldier brick fashion like that. So are you having that lasered like that?
Yeah. Yeah. And so again, you know, the process, it sounds complicated, and I would never be able to figure it out. But the process is you take a picture of that window straight on, import that picture into your CAD program, and it becomes the background, and then you just trace over it. So you're not drawing soldier
just
course bricks.
Scratch.
Yeah, you're just tracing, basically. So it makes the process easier and a lot faster. And then once you've got one drawing of one type of window done,
yeah,
you just copy and paste it wherever you need it.
So Bob, when you do your CAD for some of the things you do, is it like that, or are you typically starting from scratch?
Now, Bob does it right.
Again, with the maximum amount of difficulty possible, I think the fun part, I use fun in quotes, is a lot of the time what I have is a old picture and of a structure that's been demolished decades ago. The good news is nobody can go and prove that I've got the dimensions wrong, but
right.
I'll do a similar thing Scott's talking about, of taking that photo, importing it, and then trying to straighten it as best as possible in Photoshop to rectangles and squares. But yeah, it's very similar. And I'm finding, you know, I was building more in styrene than wood, but have been doing structures sort of hybrid, where I'm 3D printing things like windows and detail parts and stuff like that, and sticking them into styrene or wood, and coming out with the results I think are pretty good.
You know, I've always felt like I'm the most comfortable with I feel I've always said I can make anything I need to out of plastic, like the roundhouse segment there, Scott, you know, was an example of that. But this whole new section on the branch that I'm doing, it's all wood construction, and I'm enjoying the hell out of it. It's like nice to work with wood sometimes, you know, a different material. You said something, Bob, about you know, putting a photo into Photoshop and straightening the photo out. Well, I had pictures of the Pittston Yard office in my era, and they were a little bit skewed, and they had awnings and things on them that wouldn't necessarily be right if you just printed it up like that and put it on the building.
Right, right.
I was lamenting this fact. I think on the group, or maybe one of the other groups that I'm involved in, and my buddy Lance Minheim direct messaged me, and he says, I can show you how to do that. So I thought, cool. So Lance had me get a couple of little utilities. I couldn't even tell you what they are offhand, but he uses one for this and one for that, and he does Photoshop for this. And we spent like a couple of hours in a couple of sessions. He remoted into my machine or vice versa, and I am telling you, it was like drinking from a fire hose. But Lance knows his stuff when it comes to manipulating
photos. Yes, Lance is awesome with it.
He was kind enough to help me, like, you know, straighten out and make some of these pictures usable. I think we were also working on structures from some photos that I took for the Pittston Yard backdrop. An engineer buddy of mine on the Reading and Northern had gotten me into the yard, and I was able to take pictures from the perspective of being inside Pittston Junction. And as it turns out, when I tried to go back later and take some better pictures of just the homes themselves, I had no way of replicating the right view, and I ended up having to go back and utilizing the pictures that I took from Pittston Junction. But, you know, they're sort of like spread out in a bit of an arc, you know, because you're just kind of, you know, chunk, 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 chunk like that. So he helped a great deal to straighten those out. And Mike Confalone did some work on that for me. But I ended up thinking, if I had to do that again myself, it's like if you don't do a lot of it and keep doing it, you know, what I remember of what Lance told me, if I had an ounce of brains, I would have recorded it. You know, I should have done it in a Zoom and just recorded it so I could play it back, you know, because that was probably, I'm going to say, 2 years ago. And there's been a lot of water over the dam in 2 years. You know what I mean?
I'll just call Lance up. He's not doing anything else, you know.
Well, you know, he's such a nice guy that I'm sure he would, but I couldn't like impose upon him every time I had to do something like that. He just posted something about his most recent book. And I think I made a snarky comment about how he's obviously found a way to clone himself. And I was wondering if it was the clone that did the book or the real Lance that did the book. Cause obviously one guy couldn't do everything that he does. I've been accused of not sleeping too. And I guess when you put a lot of stuff out there for people to see, it probably gives the illusion of, you know, just working nonstop on everything when it really couldn't be further from the truth. You know, I have a lot of my work is home office, you know, on the IT side, all of this crap behind me. So I'm very often passing through the model shop or passing through the layout room. And there's a lot of things we do. My wife always kids me, you know, I go down after dinner and I'll say, I'm going to go. She said, I know you're going to glue something. I said, exactly. So, you know, when you go buy things, you know, you can glue something up and go off, do what you have to do on the way back down. Ah, I can take the clamps off. I can glue something else. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of incremental process that can occur in these little interstitial moments, you know, that if you're just away the whole time, you can't do it, you know? So I think it gives like the illusion of this immense pace of progress when really it's just, you know, a little bit here and a little bit there, but it's more or less constant. Like in a good week, I'm doing something, even if it's just a few minutes every day, you know, and you stack enough of that up and you get actual progress, as opposed to, you know, someone who just looks at it and says, oh God, that job's too big. Couldn't possibly start that. A lot of people have trouble getting started, you know?
Well, Mike, you know, we talked about this for years too. And, you know, you're not only highly organized and highly motivated, but you've got a schedule and a plan that you work from.
I'll get back to you in the organization. You're right on the schedule plan because I'm a project manager by trade. And one of my buddies told me the other day, the guy I've known since a kid, he says, you've always had a five-year plan. You had a five-year plan when you were 12. really? I don't remember that either, but I'll bet I did.
I'll bet you did too. You know, and I think
I was going to say part of Lance's genius, and I think he'd own up to this very well, is, and it's partly because he's essentially a professional model railroader, is that he's perfected a lot of techniques that aren't that hard to do, and he's got such a great eye that they look fabulous when they're done. But it's pretty he's the first one to say, you know, find a way that works for you and do it over and over again. And
he made a good point about, cause I think I had him on the show last year, but he's talked a lot about how, again, pick your battles, right? He said, if he builds a house or a structure and you're not going to see the back, he doesn't put anything on the back of it. You know, it's just a plain piece of whatever. So he picks his spots as to where he puts the effort, which when you think about it, makes complete sense. Unlike when you go on this curtain wall building where one side of it faces the backdrop, I'm doing all the windows and it's being built just like the front. Cause I look at it this way. I say, you know, it's not right up against the backdrop and you might be taking a picture looking down the tracks or something. And you would see if it was a blank piece of cardboard or something there, you know what I mean? So Not taking any chances. And I'm enjoying building this building. I mean, you know, how many people build a curtain wall building out of individual little pieces? You got to be a little off to do something like that. But it was the only way I could get, you know, the proportions I needed on this particular structure.
I'm really glad you're doing it, Mike, because one of the buildings that is part of this this next exhibit is a curtain wall building.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm basically going to take your instruction manual, and now, you know, mine is not brick.
Well, you may find, well, neither is, I mean, it depends, right? The building can be filled in with anything, but the key is getting that whole concrete superstructure right.
Yep. Yeah, this is all concrete.
There's plenty of commercial curtain wall kits available, which I had hoped to use for this thing. Then when I started looking at it, it's a weird building because it's only 26 feet wide, and I think it's 76 feet long. So it's a very long and narrow and tall kind of building. So every single commercial kit that I looked for that had a completely different curtain wall spacing in terms of, you know, the widths and the heights. And I said, This has suddenly turned into a scratch build.
Yeah.
Now you may find that yours is more standard and you can kit bash it out of commercial parts.
Well, I tried. I looked at ITLA.
Right.
And in fact, I met with them when I went out. That was one of the reasons why I went out to Springfield, because I was really hopeful that, you know, I could save a little bit of time and use their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't. They make beautiful, beautiful walls.
Oh yeah.
But I think, you know, I looked at this and of all of the buildings in this complex, I think this is probably, you know, one of the easier to build. It's just, you know, it's just layers.
I have a zillion pieces in this thing.
Because
in part because the brick pieces that I'm using, I have a mixture of full thickness monster brick material, but I also had some that laser board monster brick stuff. So I had to layer that on top of some basswood backing.
Yep.
And you know, you've got the brick pieces, you've got the windowsills, you've got the windows themselves, you've got the glazing, and you know, you multiply. I mean, I've actually got each side and its component parts in little individual baggies. You know, you talked about organization, but the way that I work like a madman until I get to a point where I can't work anymore because every surface is covered and every tool is out and I can't find anything. And then I do a massive cleanup of everything. And then it's like, wow, I can really work now. And then the whole process kind of repeats itself, you know? So unfortunately, I haven't found a way around that. That's just how I work.
Well, I don't think that part is unusual for a lot of modelers. You know, they get so wrapped up in the project that they don't see what's collecting under their feet or under the benchwork.
Well, when I do that cleanup, I find stuff that I thought, whoa, I've been looking for this for years.
Yep.
And there it is.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
And tools, too. That's the other problem. That's why I need multiples of every single
tool. Oh, I've got, and you know, I've
any
got,
given
I've
time, got, I can find one.
I've got a work area in the basement, and I've got another work area in the garage. And I have separate tools for each space because I know if I have to, you know, go back and forth carrying things, that A, it's going to slow down the process, but B, I'm going to lose things.
Right, right.
So if they can just stay where they're supposed to be, you know, I'll always have one set someplace.
Well, as you know, because you've been to my place, I've got the modeling shop and then I've got the woodworking shop. Mm-hmm. And what I found is as the layout gets more and more completed, there's just no place to put anything in the layout room. So it encroaches back into the modeling shop. So I've had to continually reorganize and put up more shelves and find places for things, which is helpful because now I can find them again. But increasingly, the stuff that I'm working on is large enough that I end up building a lot of it in the woodworking shop right on top of my table saw.
Yeah.
So, and then if I have to use the table saw for something, it's like, oh, I have to clean all of that stuff off the table saw. You know, it's It can be annoying. Fortunately, I just brought another table saw online.
I saw that.
Find stuff, and that's actually paying, you know, big dividends. So, you know, I've been accused of having too many tools, and I say, oh, come on.
Yeah. We learn as we go. You know, these exhibits, you know, I the first one I built like I would have built a model railroad.
Right.
And
well, it had tracks.
Well, it had tracks, so it's a model railroad.
Yeah. These others have no tracks in them?
They all have tracks in
them. Okay, they all have tracks.
Yeah, the criteria, if you will, is that they're all railroad related or,
gotcha.
Or track side buildings. There were quite a few mills, quite a few woolen mills and straw hat mills in Franklin. And like I say, we were abundantly served by rail. But I learned, you know, you build this thing like a model railroad and you border it with Masonite, and, you know, Masonite is going to be the weakest link in this chain. And you got people coming in, you know, by the tens and twenties, you know, that want to get up close and personal with this thing. And, you know, next thing you know, the Masonite is getting, dinged. So, you know, someone said, well, why don't you build the sides out of half inch plywood?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that's just so simple and so brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder why I didn't think of it.
A little heavier.
A little heavier, but it's not going to get damaged. And I don't have to build these elaborate carrying devices.
Just pick it up by the face.
When I take it off the legs to pack it up in these crates when they go off exhibit, you know, we can just lift it up by the half inch plywood and set it in the box.
Right. Is there any provision, if you had enough space, that all of the modules could be positioned adjacent to one another and
scene? They are positioned, you know, one right after the other because they are linear. But they do not connect. And people will ask, well, you know, can you connect these? And the answer is, yeah, I could connect them, but we're not running trains. So there's no point in connecting them. Mm-hmm. And I would just have to unconnect them, you know, to, you know, pack them away. But the other piece too, is that, you know, where there is a little bit of selective compression is in the length of these things. So sure. For instance, the first exhibit I did was 8 feet long. But if I had built it to scale, it would have been 22 feet long.
I mean, what scene are you modeling that you don't compress, right? I mean, Pittston Yard here is 22 feet long, but it would probably need to be 100 feet long if I was going to model it to prototype length.
Well, that's why you have to do a short line in 1924. Baltimore Yard is, mine is probably 7 feet long, and it's to scale.
Well, and your motive power and your rolling stock is proportionate to that too, right?
Oh yeah.
I mean, you have you must have some 30-foot cars, right?
30-foot, 34-foot, few 40s, but
was it a lot of coal for that railroad?
You know, it was one of the nice things about it, a lot of different commodities: coal, milk, a lot of stone. They had quarries up near the Pennsylvania border that had a lot of traffic. And then, you know, weird stuff like, you know, a cigar factory and a piano factory and a chain factory. It's a lot
Do
of
you both have piano factories that you...
Yeah, that's interesting.
We're all over the place.
Wow.
Yeah, we had a company in Franklin called the Trowbridge Piano Factory, Trowbridge Piano Company. And they manufactured pianos into the early 1900s. In the period that I was modeling, it was bought by a furniture company who used it as a warehouse. But we actually have examples of Trowbridge pianos at the museum.
Wow.
So, you know, what I tried to do was incorporate as much of the area as I could into these exhibits. So, for instance, where this coal and grain company existed, there's an embankment and there's kind of an upper level parking lot and then the train station level parking lot. And this company sat in where what's now this upper level parking lot. But I was curious, as I was, because I wanted to site the buildings as accurately as I could on the exhibit. I was walking along the embankment to try to see if there was any sign of where this coal company was. And what I found was a ton of coal, pieces of
Probably
coal.
filled in the trestle, right?
Well, there was no trestle, actually. It was just a hole in the middle of the tracks that had a conveyor that lifted it up into the tower. But I knew exactly where that conveyor was because of all this leftover coal
Still
that
there.
was in the embankment. And the coal company was torn down in the early 1960s. But the railroad...
It was then basically for home heating, I would guess.
Home heating, yeah. So it was all hard coal. So what I did was I took a 5-gallon bucket and I shoveled up some dirt and I picked up some coal and I ground up the coal.
How did
And
you
I
do
used,
that? What did you use for it? Just a hammer and a bag?
Yeah. Although what also works well is one of these old cast iron meat grinders. You shove the coal in the hopper and it's got to be small enough, and you grind it up.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you, of course, have one of these.
Doesn't everyone?
Yeah.
It's good because when I use my wife's Cuisinart to do that, she was not happy.
Yeah, it's there are some things that are kind of taboo. The second exhibit involved a 3-stall locomotive roundhouse that in and of itself was an interesting structure because it was tin clad, and it was the only tin clad roundhouse I've ever heard of. But the backstory to how it came to be would make anyone understand why it was tin clad. Basically, money was donated to build it. The railroad said, "We'll build it, but we're not going to spend beyond what was given to us." So they built the absolute cheapest structure they could find. It only had 8 windows in the whole building.
Imagine what this light was like inside.
Imagine what it must have been like working in that place in January or July.
Yeah.
There are only really 2 pictures that existed of the building. So it was a little bit of fly by night, but that you can walk down into that area now. It's overgrown, but you can still get down there. And I found some soft coal in there. And I got some dirt from in there, and I used that dirt and that coal in that
can't
portion
beat
of the
real
exhibit.
materials for this kind of thing.
No, you can't.
Most
But when you're
most of the cinder ballast from my yard came from some secret location along the Boston and Albany, believe it or not.
Okay.
That a buddy of mine had found, and he brought over like a 2/3 full Home Depot orange bucket and said, "Use all you want." And I said, "Better mean that."
So
I used it all.
Why is it secret, Mike?
I don't think he wanted anybody else going in there and taking more out of it.
Okay. That's
I
interesting.
Asked him where it was more than once, and he was very evasive with his memory of where it was. He just didn't, he stood up well under cross-examination. Bob, you have like a little side business, right? Where you actually sell things that you have produced on your 3D printing?
No, I haven't done that. Well, I had some,
that's
I have
fiction.
Designs up on Shapeways that, that people
What kinds
buy.
of things would somebody find there that you?
Oh, it's quite a grab bag. I've got some Model T models and a couple of scales. I've got windows. I've got the phone booths, traffic lights, things like that,
Phone
sort of.
booths, interesting.
Yeah.
And little HO scale Supermen to, no.
Right. That'd be fun.
If I asked you to draw up and print a Nash Rambler, you'd be able to do that?
I'd give
It's
it a
my
go.
white whale for vehicles. I
Is
need
that
one
right?
for a display on top of a junkyard. Somebody made it long
How
ago.
angular is it? How
I'm sorry?
angular?
It's
How
pretty
angular
rounded,
is it?
actually.
Yeah, that's the hard part in 3D modeling is
Right.
rounded. And somebody wanted me to do a boat, and I gave it a go, and it just, it was.
Is it the drawing that's hard or the printing?
Drawing. It's, and there are more advanced programs that I think you can do curved and.
Yeah, like
Surface
SolidWorks or something
or
like that, maybe.
Shape or SketchUp is not that good at it. It likes straight lines and things like that.
That's like another career. Well, listen, I'm not disappointed with how interesting this conversation has been. Does anybody have anything they like to throw in at the end here?
Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to. I would be remiss if I sat here and took all of the credit for these exhibits. They're just battles that you can't fight when you're up against a timeline like I've been with these, and there were people that just stepped up out of the goodness of their heart and just really did whatever they could to help. My good buddy Ron Ricci, whom I grew up with and we got into the hobby together, who belongs to the New Haven Railroad Historical Society, has found all sorts of information. And, if I called him up right now and said, hey, he lives in Connecticut, get up here right now, we're going on a field trip, he'd be up here immediately. Loves that stuff. Bob Leonard down in Florida, whom was essential in finding the right locomotives for me. Carlos Ozolinski out in the Detroit area donated 20 built period vehicles. Wouldn't take a penny for them. So many people. My buddy Sam Maxwell has done the difficult CAD work, the stuff I can't do, and is an ace with the laser cutter. So those people have really made this thing possible. So I just want to make sure they get the proper credit.
Excellent. Well, Bob, you let us know here that for the Mid-Atlantic RPM, that's marpm.org. If anybody wants information about the meet itself, it's one of the better meets that I've never been to, but it's on the list. So
good.
The other one's the St. Louis meet, but boy, the time of year they have that. I've been to St. Louis at that time of year, and I don't know. Air conditioning is your friend there. Let me just put it that way. You also have your own website, bobstrackplans.com, which is a
pretty imaginative, huh? Yeah.
Easy one to remember. So somebody could actually go there and say, hey, I've got this amount of space and I'd like to do something along these lines, and you would come up with a track plan.
Indeed. And there are a lot of the plans that I've done are posted there along with some pics of my railroad. So it'd be a good place if anybody wants to check it out.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, it's been a pleasant evening. Thanks for everything. And
thanks, Mike.
See everybody maybe next month or maybe in a month. It's not a regular schedule, but we made the February show. That's what counts here. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Mike.
Great to see you, Scott.
You too, Bob.